All right, so today we're going to be doing everybody's favorite topic, tithing. Woohoo! I bet you heard a few of those sermons over the years. All right, but probably nothing like what you're going to hear today. Now, we did have a teaching, an original teaching that we were doing called Tithing, Giving for Beginners. I think I'm going to change the title for this one. I'm going to call it Tithing, Appreciating Blessings. Okay, tithing, colon, appreciating blessings. Okay, the Tithing, Giving for Beginners one is going to be almost all that information will still be included in this teaching because we're redoing the teaching. It wasn't on video last time, so we are doing I just said we're not going to redo a bunch of stuff. Well, we are going to redo teachings that need to be redone every so many years because they need to be redone, but we're not going to do the every year thing. Okay, so here, this tithing teaching needed to be redone. People have asked a lot of questions that the first one didn't clarify with enough detail or wasn't clear enough, so we're going to try to do that also in this teaching. So we're calling this Tithing, Appreciating Blessings. Excuse me. And so before we get started, I want us to understand that tithing is absolutely one of the three or four things out there that get attacked on a regular basis by those that don't want to do it. All right? There are people that will attack Sabbath keeping, feast keeping, kosher eating, and tithing is one of the things that gets attacked. Not by so much the people in the mainstream churches, but the people once they come out. Okay, because they want to figure out the things that they didn't like to do, they'd like to believe. Let me start that again. There's a lot of things they used to like to do that they found out they can't do anymore, so they figured, why not also get rid of the things they don't want to do? So they start to do their own research in their own skewed way to try to justify that they don't have to do some of the things they don't want to do. Because after all, learning the truth took away some of the things they did like to do. So why not throw out some more stuff, like the stuff you don't want to do? And people don't like to have anybody mess with their money. Well, we have to first have an adjustment there. Whoever said it was your money? You know, it's not in my notes here, but let's go to Let's go to chapter 8. Let me add that to my notes. It was going to go in a different way. We're going to Deuteronomy 8 here. All right, so in Deuteronomy 8, it talks about, let's see where I want to start. Let's start around, start in verse 1. After all, we're going to do multiple parts here. Might as well start at the beginning, all right? So guard to do every command which I am commanding you today that you might live and shall increase and go in and shall possess the land of which Yahweh swore to your father. So everything that follows this is the understanding is that you are to do this so that you will live. I'm assuming that most of you, the reason you got excited about this is that walking in the walk and believing in the Creator leads to life. I don't think you did this knowing that if you did it, hey, you're just going to die anyway, so who cares? You did this because there would be life in it. Okay, not only so that you would live, but that you would increase and go in and possess the land. So now if we're looking at this as a metaphor for the future, right, this is the Exodus being talked about here, and we know that we're looking forward to a greater Exodus. So the idea of going in and possessing should be linked to the idea of entering into the forever kingdom. And possessing, in other words, being there and having it be for you. And so he says, if you guard to do every command I command you today, that you're doing this so that you might live and increase. Increase means abundance, that you might have more abundance. You might have more joy, more physical blessings, so you'd have more to live in an abundant way. So you're going to increase and you're going to go in and possess the land which Yahweh swore to your fathers. Well, we all are standing on promises of a kingdom that's coming. So it's the same idea, okay? He says, and you shall remember that Yahweh led you all the way these 40 years or through however many years of your life, we're going to use the metaphor to today, in the wilderness. Anybody feel like they've been walking in the wilderness? I certainly have felt that way. Okay, so we're walking through our personal wildernesses. Why? So we can be humbled. So that's the first part of this process is the humbling. Now, bear in mind that that includes all areas of your life, including your finances. All right, the humbling. Because there's a way that seems right to man, and that way leads to?
Death.
All right, so let's not think we're so smart. Because if we're going to do it our way, it's going to only lead to death. He's saying this way, the way that comes from above, leads to life. All right, so We're going through this wilderness, and first step is to get humbled. Because after all, if you're sitting on the self-sovereign throne, we talk about this almost every week, then you're not going to end up anywhere but in the death ditch. Okay? Because then you're sitting on the throne, which means that you are deciding which way to go and the way that seems right to you, and that way leads to death. We have other verses that says it's not even a man to know which way to place his own feet. We've got all kinds of great verses telling you just how wonderfully smart we are. Okay? And so that should be there to humble us. He says, and it's also for him to prove, to know what is in our hearts, whether we want to guard his commands or not. Because after all, he's going to want to have a kingdom full of people that are going to be submissive to his authority, trusting that when we are, it brings the life and the abundance. Remember, we talk about commandment keeping as doing three things, right? It blesses you. It keeps you safe, right? We read in Deuteronomy 28, right, the blessings chapter. We're going to read that actually part of it here in chapter 8 as well. The idea that when you obey, it brings blessing. Just like the idea of living and going in and possessing is a blessing. He says if you guard and obey, you get to have these blessings. So Torah observance absolutely 100% brings blessing. It also keeps you safe. If there's no murder or adultery or stealing or et cetera, this is a safer place to be. Would we not agree? We have that going on. And then he says, so I want to know whether it's in your heart to guard the commands or not. And it says, and he did humble you. So we're looking now back at Israel coming out of the Egyptian Exodus, coming out of Egypt here. He said, and he let you suffer hunger, but fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know. So let's take that for a second. So if you actually were successfully humbled, and by the way, all of us have been through that process where we have been humbled. Problem is we didn't stay there. Humble is not like a status that once you have it, you get to keep it forever. You have to embrace it and walk it and live it. So you've had humbling experiences where he's shown you just how smart you aren't and how much you need him and how much smarter he is than you. And you were humbled. When you thought you knew everything and you thought you were so right and only found out how wrong you were, but you didn't necessarily stay there, but you had to stay there. And he said, look, he humbled you and let you suffer hunger because it's when you're hungry you realize that you're not so smart, you need him for things. Problem is, some of us manage to, after being humbled, provide some things and get some abundance, and so we feel all comfortable again and not like we're needing him. We're going to talk about that as we get through this chapter. He says, but he fed you with manna. Now, you were hungry, but he fed you with manna, which you did not know. Now, manna in Hebrew is the Hebrew word just mana, which means what's this? So he said, he fed you with stuff that you didn't know what it was. He said, what's this? And all of us are going through that same process in our spiritual shifting, our paradigm shifting, is that he's not feeding us the way we were fed before, with the stuff that we were fed on before and the stuff that we were suckling at before and the kind of milk we were drinking before. He's now feeding us with different stuff. So he says, yeah, you were hungry, but he provided you with food, and some of you were still hungry even getting the food. And that's a problem still in the body where they're getting food, and yet they still want to run off getting other stuff too because the food somehow isn't satisfying them. So they got to run around looking for more stuff. It's like the person who sits down has a really nice lunch or a really nice supper, and then they're going and snacking on junk afterwards because after all, it wasn't enough. Why wasn't it enough? Why didn't you eat to satisfaction and were full? Why do you need more? Why do you need the junk? Well, we have that still in the body. This is a part of it is a Gnostic sort of thing we still have in us, this feeding and chasing after information and knowledge. And so we think that knowledge will feed us. No, information in a relational way will feed you. Let me say that again. Knowledge or information, a knowing, a relational knowing is what will feed you. Information in itself will leave you quite unsatisfied and you'll want more information and more information and more information. What you need is a relational knowledge. Information with relationship, that's called knowing. Okay, and scripture uses the word knowing. So he fed you with stuff that you didn't understand. He said, nor did your fathers know it. Did your fathers know this stuff? No. See, the metaphor is great. It plays out really nicely. And he says, the reason he did this is to make you know. He wanted to make you know that man doesn't live by his own efforts alone. That's kind of a better translation, I think. In other words, by your own efforts, your own ways, your own smarts, your own things. He said, no, but you're going to need to live by every word, everything that comes from above. Your own efforts is not going to make this work. Because it's not like somebody might say as a wise guy, well, I know I can't live on bread alone. I got to eat vegetables and I got to eat fruit and I got to eat stuff. No, he's saying, look, this is not a one-to-one literal. This isn't a pashat. He says, you need to know that your own ways of producing and getting and filling your own needs is only going to get you so far. You need more. And so I'm going to let you be hungry and suffer and feed you with other things until you realize you need what comes from me. You can only get so far without what I provide. That's what he's telling you. Then he says, look, your garments didn't wear out on you, nor did your foot swell for 40 years. He said, thus you shall know in your heart that as a man disciplines his son, so Yahweh, your Elohim, disciplines you. Therefore, you shall guard the commands of Yahweh, your Elohim, to walk in his ways and to fear him. Okay, this is the reason for the discipline, by the way. The reason for the discipline is so that you would guard the commands and learn to fear Yahweh, to walk in his ways, to realize that his ways do bring the abundance. Now listen, verse 7. For Yahweh, this is why he's doing all of this. All of that we read so far is to let you know, back to this living and increasing and going in. He says, for Yahweh, your Elohim, is bringing you into a good land, a land of streams, of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you eat bread without scarcity, in which you do not lack at all, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you dig copper. That sounds like pretty good stuff. That's some blessing. And of course, it's not necessarily just literal, which it is, but it's also the metaphor saying, I will provide all that you could possibly need to abundance and to satisfaction, and you'll never lack anything if you will just learn to guard my commands and walk in my ways and fear me. And then he says in verse 10, he goes, and you shall eat and be satisfied. See, a lot of us eat and we're not satisfied. He's saying, if you do this my way, you'll eat and actually be satisfied. You'll eat and be satisfied and shall bless Yahweh your Elohim for the good land which he has given you. So you'll bless him for, in other words, you'll recognize the source. You'll recognize the source. He says, be on guard though, because this is our human nature. Like I told you, you were humbled at one point and then maybe you didn't stay there. Well, guess what? You start getting all this abundance, you're eating and you're satisfied and everything seems great. You could forget. He says, be on guard lest you forget Yahweh, your Elohim, by not guarding his commands, his right rulings, and his laws, which I command you today. So that's your evidence that you're no longer remembering Yahweh, but you're forgetting, is that you're going to stop in your guarding. You're going to get weak in your guarding of his commands. He says, lest you eat and shall be satisfied and build lovely houses and dwell in them, and your herds and your flocks increase, and your silver and gold are increased, and all that you have is increased, that your heart then becomes lifted up and you forget Yahweh your Elohim, who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim, out from the house of bondage. You forget where you came from. And you forget how you got to where you are now and where all the abundance comes from. He brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim and the house of bondage, who led you through the great and awesome wilderness, fiery serpents and scorpions and thirst, where there were no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, in order to humble you and to try you, to do you good in the end. You know, we just spent 8 parts on endure and endure the trials, right? Endure and receive the crown of life. Well, the whole point was, right, going through all of that because he intends to do good to you in the end. But he's not going to do the good to you in the end if you don't go through the process and come out of it changed. The last part we didn't mention is the third thing that Torah does is it transforms you from what you are. It changes you from what you are into what he is. That's what he wants you to do. So when you go through the transformation process, you can receive the good he intended for you in the end. But he intends it for the transformed, conformed you that is transformed and conformed to the image of his son. He doesn't intend it for you the way you are now. He doesn't intend you to receive all these things, you know, come as you are, stay that way, and here you go. Here's all your presents, all your gifts, all your blessings. No. There's a process. That's why there's trials. That's why he says he disciplines you like a father disciplines a son. But his intent is to give you all these blessings. Remember, I told you this teaching's got a subtitle of appreciating the blessings, okay? Appreciating that you're receiving blessings. You then shall say in your heart, oh, my power and strength in my hand have made me this wealth. Now, it's not that you're going to get all prideful and say, oh, I did this. It's just that you're going to think that you don't need him. Hey, I'm doing okay now. I'm chugging along. The bills are getting paid. Food's on the table. Life is good. And you forget who provides you these things. He says, but you shall remember, verse 18, Yahweh your Elohim, for it is he who gives you the power to get the wealth in order to establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is today. See, we're going to talk about tithing, which deals with wealth and deals with financing. Let's not forget, like I started this all off with, why do you even think it's your money? It says that he gives you power to get the finances, the wealth, the abundance. Why did he do it, by the way? So that you could just be a spoiled brat? Sorry, was that too obvious and blunt? Or is he doing it in order to establish his covenant? What is the covenant? The covenant is simple. If you obey, I will provide your every need. I will provide you with anything and everything you could possibly need. I will fill your life with joy and plenty. You will be safe. You'll be provided for. You'll eat to satisfaction. No one will make you afraid. All you need to do is listen and do. Shema. Okay? So he says, look, you got to remember that Yahweh Elohim, it's he who gives you the power to get the wealth, and it's to establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as is today. This is very important. But it shall be, if you by any means forget Yahweh your Elohim and follow after other mighty ones and serve them and bow yourself to them, I have warned you, this day you shall certainly perish. Like the nations with Yahweh is destroying before you, so you are to perish because you did not obey the voice of Yahweh your Elohim. By the way, that should also tell you why those nations before them were perishing, because they, at some point, had a relationship that they rejected. They didn't obey through their generational disobedience. And so he says here very clearly, look, there's a process here that you're going through. There's a wilderness journey. There's a humbling. And all of this is because I want to provide you with everything that you could ever want. Even things that you would never even have thought of that you might even desire. He knows before you could even ask. And some of you know what that means, to have him provide things before you even thought to ask for them. Things that you never would have thought to ask. And you're just, it makes you so happy and he takes such good care of you. Yet, we start to think that somehow some of the stuff we have is ours. This is mine. Really? This verse says, don't forget who gave you the power to get whatever you think is yours. How did you get what you have? Well, I earned it. I went to work. Well, who gave you the talent to do whatever you do at work? Where'd the skills come from? Who gave you the power to have all that? As you look at this tithing thing, let's understand that what we're dealing with is an appreciation for blessings. So when he asks you to give back some of what's already his anyway that he gave you to be a steward over, why do you have such a reluctance to do that? I want to ask you a question. How many of you, if I walked up to you and said, I want to hand you $100, but I just want to make sure that if I do, you give me 10 of it back. Anybody want to sign up for that plan? But that's the plan. He offers you all that he offers you, and he just wants you to use 10% for another purpose. And we're going to get into how that all is scripturally written out. But you don't think of it that way. You think of it that he's taking away from you, that this is coming out of your pocket because it's yours. No. It says here, don't forget, he gave you the power to get whatever you have. And by the way, if you don't have, that's maybe because you've got an obedience problem you need to fix, and then you will have. Maybe part of that obedience problem is the tithing. And by the way, let me just kind of preemptively say before we go any further in this teaching, I used to have a problem doing this teaching when I would do it very rarely. I would do this teaching like once every 5 or 6 years to do it, you know, to kind of update it, where I always felt like it was a struggle to do because somehow I would be looked at as self-serving because after all, in ministry, you receive the tithes and the offerings. But you know what? I don't have that problem anymore because I don't need a penny out of any of you. If Abba wants to pay me, he can pay me with anybody, anywhere on the planet, any which way he wants. It doesn't have to be you. So I want to make this clear that there's no thought in my head and shouldn't be one in yours that any of this has anything to do with anybody but you. This teaching is about you and what your relationship is with him and how what you do with your money and how that affects your relationship with him. It has nothing to do with the ministry. We have plenty, and if we need more, he'll give it to us if that's what he wants to do. It has nothing to do with you. We are not a ministry that's trying to make you feel guilty or bad so that we get more money in our box. This isn't about us. I've seen him put money in a box that nobody else could have put in a box. I've seen a, from the bank with the tape around it, thing of 20s that would not fit through the slot in our box. I'm not worried about money for us. This is about you, and I want you to only be listening to this about how it's about you, about your relationship with him, and about the abundance that you could have or should be having. This isn't a health, wealth gospel. He simply says here, I provide you the ability to have wealth, and if you obey, you should have abundance. Now, he's not going to give you overwhelming abundance in the dispersion. We're still in the punishment, but it'll give you satisfaction. It'll provide what you need. Key word there is need. I've got a lady in the congregation, I won't mention who it is, but over the years has told me that she's always struggled financially, but knows the only reason that they always had enough was because she tithed. See, other people in her same situation would have thought, I can't afford to tithe. She understood that she couldn't afford not to. And she will tell you, yes, we have struggled in this family, but we've always had food on the table and a place to live, and I really believe, she'll tell you, it's because of the tithing. See, we need to have a paradigm shift and a head adjustment. Our thought process is all screwy. Let's now look at some of the instructions dealing with tithing. The first place that we find this instructed is in Leviticus 27. It's not the first mention of it, but this is the first instruction about it. In Leviticus 27, and we're going to look at verse 30, and I'm going to start laying out some things and building a case for what I think it really means. Now, in verse 30 says, and all the tithe of the land, of the seed of the land, and or of the fruit of the tree belongs to Yahweh. It is set apart to Yahweh. So first of all, he's telling you that all of the tithe is his, of whatever's out there. Now, I know a lot of people want to take this so literally. They say, well, he's only talking about seed or fruit. Well, later he's also going to talk about animals. But we're going to see that we have to take this beyond just the Peshat. Because the process of tithing is about appreciating blessings. It's also teaching you how to be a giver. You know, if you were part of the Orthodox Jewish community and you were a Kabbalist, in other words, you understood Kabbalah at all, and I'm not here to teach you that, but the very basic concept in the Kabbalah is that the Creator is the ultimate idea of giving, and we as the creation are the receptacle of that giving, and that life is a journey to become like Him, a giver. Boy, wasn't that scary magic? Kabbalah is such magic. What people don't know in their ignorance and what they say is just unbelievable. That's the simplicity of what the Kabbalists are trying to understand, is that our Creator is the ultimate idea of giving. He created us to receive that giving. That's why we're here, with the idea that we would transform to be like Him, givers. Hopefully that was very simplistic and very clear. And so what we're looking at here is that it says, all the tithe belongs to Yahweh. So don't even think of it as yours. So when you get your abundance, whatever that is, why do you even think of that 10% as being yours? He already tells you all of the tithe is his. That tenth is his. So why would you even think of it like he's taking your money or your stuff? I mean, I already told you it's all his, but very clearly he says it's set apart. It's kadosh. It's set apart to Yahweh. If a man indeed redeems any of the tithes, he adds a fifth to it. He says, you want it? Great, go ahead and take it. Now you're going to have to pay a fifth. The entire tithe of the herd and of the flock, all that passes under the rod, the tenth one is set apart to Yahweh. He does not inquire whether it is good or spoiled, nor does he exchange it. And if he exchanged it at all, then both of them, the one he exchanged and the other one, are both set apart. If you try to exchange it. Because what happens is you're sitting there with your flock and you go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh man, the 10th one is so beautiful and so perfect and so. Don't think that way. That one's Yahweh's. Matter of fact, you should give him the best one. He gives you everything anyway. Why would you give him the best one? He says, the one exchanged for it is set apart and is not redeemed. These are the commands which Yahweh commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai. Now, let's go to Numbers chapter 18. So we start off with the idea that the tithe belongs to Yahweh, whatever that is all about. Remember, we're going to kind of make a case here for all these things. Numbers chapter 18 and in verse 20. Yahweh said to Aaron, you are not to have an inheritance in their land, nor have any portion in their midst. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. Now, previous to this, we have the Pidyon HaBen. Let's see where it says that. Okay, let's go back to verse 13. First fruits of all that is there in their land, which they bring to Yahweh, are yours. Everyone who is clean in your house eats it. All that is dedicated in Israel is yours. Everyone opening the womb of all flesh, which they bring to Yahweh, whether man or beast, is yours. But the firstborn of man you shall certainly ransom, and the firstborn of the unclean beast you ransom, and the ransom and they and ransom their ransomed ones when 1 month old, according to your valuation, 5 shekels of silver, according to the shekel of the set apart place, which is 20 gerahs. Okay? So it says that there's a ransoming that's the 5 shekels. By the way, that's where this came from. We started making these coins for, this is called Pidyon HaBen, the redeeming of the firstborn, where you could use shekels of silver. This is a 1 ounce silver coin that we make at MTOI. Okay? And that was because people had wanted to do this ceremony. It's talked about other places in Numbers, but it's also here in Numbers 18, because this is where we're now going to understand that in redeeming the firstborn and having the Levites now to be in that place that the firstborns would have been to serve Yahweh, that they are to have no inheritance. Now, previous to this, they were laying out the understanding that each of the tribes would get an area of land, and that would be an inheritance. And that among the tribes, each of the families would have an inheritance, a land that was theirs. This is why we have the Shemitah year and the Yovel, the Jubilee years, the idea of making sure that the land was maintained by those who were given it as an inheritance, that you wouldn't lose your inheritance. And so here, we're talking to the Levites and saying, you... Verse 20, right? Yahweh says to Aaron, you are not to have an inheritance in their land being the other tribes. He says, nor have any portion in their midst. I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. And see, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the service which they are serving, the service of the tent of meeting. All right, now we're going to put another piece into here. So the tithes which belong to Yahweh are now being given to the Levites because they have no other portion. Why? So that it's to provide for them so that they can do what? It's in return for the service with which they serve. You see, the serving that's needed is needed 24/7, 365, whatever way you want to word it, all the time. And so they can't be possibly out there with their herds and with their crops and doing all the other things they're doing to provide a living if they are serving 24/7 all year long. He says, you have a job, and that job is going to be provided for by the tithes and the offerings. So let's keep that idea here because, again, there are people that attack tithing today because they want to, and they don't even realize they're doing this, they want to go from a Peshat level. Well, it says here to give it to the Levites, and we don't have Levites today, so we don't have to do it. Well, on a deeper level, it's because it's providing those who should not have a portion or an inheritance because they are serving in the work of service of the Tent of Meeting. And what was the Tent of Meeting? That was where all the decisions were being made. That's where the sacrifices and offerings, but that's where decisions, judgment, leadership, counsel, all these things that were being done came from the Tent of Meeting. So those who are serving in this, as he calls it, for the service which they serve. So now you may want to say, are there people today doing that, even though they're not Levites necessarily, and there's no Tent of Meeting? Just keep that thought. So this is what's going on here. Okay, so we have, continuing in verse 21, he says, and see, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes for the service. And then verse 22, and let the children of Israel no more come near the tent of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. So now we are told that the Levites have a role that nobody else is supposed to be doing. It's their role. That should be also a deeper level of understanding that if you're not called to ministry and to leadership or to the priesthood, so to speak, and we'll talk about this from a Melchizedekian versus Levitical in a minute here. If you're not called to that, then you have no business stepping into that role. Let's be clear. He said, no longer should the children of Israel, who are not the Levites, come near the tent to do this work. He says, the Levites shall do the service of the tent of meeting, verse 23. So they themselves bear their crookedness, a law forever throughout your generations, that among the children of Israel they are to have no inheritance. They are completely to depend. Remember it said in Deuteronomy that I allowed you to be hungry so that you wouldn't feel like you could provide for yourself, that you'd always need provision from me. Guess what full-time ministry is? I'm not talking about the guys with the five planes and the 75 cars. I'm saying it should be a place where you know without Abba providing, you have nothing. I have no idea what's going to be in that box at the end of every Sabbath. I have no idea whether or not anybody's going to hit PayPal as a donation. I'm completely at the mercy of Abba inspiring somebody to do something. I have no inheritance. That's the same idea, the same role. But let's continue. The Levites are going to do this service. He says, but verse 24, but the tithes of the children of Israel, which they present as a contribution to Yahweh, I have given them to the Levites as an inheritance. That is why I have said to them among the children of Israel, they have no inheritance. So realize this, got to be clear. If you give the tithe, let's even say back then to the Levites, are you giving it to the Levites or are you giving it to Yahweh? You're giving it to Yahweh. He says, the tithes that they present as a contribution to Yahweh are given to the Levites. So let's remember, you're not giving a ministry your tithes. You're tithing to Yahweh. Now, figuring out where that is and how to do that is now the problem you're going to face. But you are giving your tithe to Yahweh because the tithe belongs to Yahweh. Now, Yahweh doesn't physically show up to collect it and pick it up and do anything with it. He does that through human beings. So here he's telling you in this case, it's to provide for the Levite, for the Levite. And Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to the Levites, we're in verse 26 now, and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithes, which I've given you, from them as your inheritance, then you shall present a contribution of it to Yahweh, a tenth of the tenth, a tithe of the tithe. The Levites now have to give a tithe to Yahweh. And he says, and your contribution shall be reckoned to you as grain from the threshing floor and as filling from the winepress. Thus you also present a contribution unto Yahweh from all the tithes which you receive from the children of Israel, and you shall give from it the contribution to Yahweh to who? To Aaron the priest. And you shall say to them, when you have presented the best of it, then the rest shall be reckoned to the Levites as the yield of the threshing floor and the yield of the winepress. Okay, so what he's saying is the Israelites were to tithe to Yahweh and give that to the Levites. The Levites were to tithe to Yahweh and give it to the Kohanim. By the way, not today, but eventually we're going to get to Malachi. You need to understand that that was what was the problem in Malachi. All Christian ministries love to say, well, you know what it says, will you rob God and how do we rob God and tithes and offerings? Well, Malachi is a chastisement of the Levites not giving to the Kohanim. It's this part right here that we just read. Now, if you are also of Israel and you're not giving it to Levites, it addresses you as well because it had to start there. But the ones being chastised in Malachi 3 are the Kohanim not getting from the Levites. The Levites were not giving to the Kohanim. So you just have to make sure that we're getting things clear. All right, so Israelites are instructed to give the tithes and offerings to Yahweh. The tithes that belong to Yahweh were to be given to the Levites. It was given to the Levites because they were to spend all of their time doing the work of service of the tent of meeting. This was to sustain them in place of having an inheritance like the other tribes. And then the Levites were to give a tithe of the tithe to the Kohanim. Are we clear so far? Okay. Now, I want to take you to something interesting right at the very beginning in Genesis chapter 4. In Genesis chapter 4. Because people will say, well, the tithe was just for the Levites, and we don't have Levites. Anybody heard that on the internet all over the place? Well, let's see that that's completely untrue. Let's go to Genesis chapter 4. And I found some really interesting things popped up when I was reading this. In Genesis chapter 4, we have, where we're up to, verse 3. And it came to be in the course of time that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to Yahweh, and Hevel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And Yahweh looked to Hevel and his offering, but he did not look to Cain and his offering. And Cain was very wroth, and his face fell. And Yahweh said to Cain, "Why are you wroth, and why is your face fallen? If you do well, is there not acceptance? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should master it." Okay, let's see what this is talking about. First of all, the brothers bring an offering to Yahweh. But the word sin is brought in there. What is sin? 1 John 3:4 says that sin is transgression of the law. Sin is Torahlessness. Okay, in case you want to make sure about that, let's just go to 1 John 3 just for a second. And in verse 4 it says, "Everyone doing sin also does lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness." Torahlessness, breaking the law. So if we're told that if you do well, you'll be accepted, and if you do not, sin is at the door, this must have been a Torah issue. In other words, they weren't just randomly out of their heart giving an offering. So my speculation is that this was tithing, because it was something they would have been instructed. This wasn't a free will offering. Because it was a free will offering is allowed to be anything. You have free will to give whatever you want to give. You know, we have that kind of an offering in Deuteronomy 16:16-17, which says three times a year, all the males are supposed to come before me, and you don't come empty-handed, and you give an offering, and the offering is based on how you've been blessed. You bless, you give as you've been blessed. Remember, I talked about tithing and offerings, everything is about appreciating your blessings. All the financial stuff is showing and demonstrating how much you appreciate the blessings you have. So I don't believe, and I don't think anybody's taught this that I've heard, and maybe other people have taught this, but I've never taught this. I don't believe that this was just an offering and doing it in a bad way. I think this is tithing. And I think that this is a Torah issue, and they knew exactly the instruction was there. Otherwise, the word sin could not be involved, because sin is a transgression of the law. So I believe that both Cain and Hevel both knew what they were expected to do. Now notice it says that Hevel gave of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat, where it just says that Cain brought some fruit. It doesn't say he brought the first fruit or the best fruit. He just brought some fruit. And so Yahweh said to him, again, this is like a parent with two children. And he said, "Look, if you do it right, won't I be proud of you too?" Now, that implies that the kid actually knew what was right. You see what we're talking about here? I mean, it was clear, at least it should be, that Yahweh, in talking to the brothers, he's saying, "Look, I instructed you. You had the instruction. You knew the right way to do this. Cain," he says, you didn't do it right. Your brother did it right. So why are you all upset? Do it right, and I'll be proud of you too." See, but this is the self-sovereign stuff. You know, this is where we fall into the big, big trap. We think Yahweh should accept what we do because we think he should. Because I did it for him. Isn't that what was going on here? Cain said, "But I brought you what I wanted to bring you." And Yahweh said, "That was all well and good, but that's not what you were instructed to do." See, you can't spin it and just do it your way. You have to do it the way he said to do it. Doing it your way does not work. Not in his eyes anyway. But people love to spin things. I like when people come up to you and say they're doing this, that, and the other thing, and I tell them, "I don't know if that's a good idea." And they go, "Well, you know, I'm sure Yahweh will be okay with it." Don't you think that's kind of what Cain was doing here? "I'm sure Yahweh will be okay with it. I'm bringing him an offering. I got fruit and stuff, and I'm going to make an offering. I didn't give him the best stuff. I didn't give him the first. I didn't give him the tithe. I didn't follow instructions, but I did, you know, it's close. It's the way I wanted to do it instead of the way he said to do it." But do we keep the Sabbath that way? Do we keep all the Torah laws that way? Are we making any mistakes where we're doing it the way I want to do it versus the way he says to do it? Is the eye getting in the way? You know, if your eye offends you, pluck it out. It causes you to sin. Maybe it's the eye, capital letter I, not the E-Y-E. Okay, if your eye causes you to stumble. I don't think I've ever said that before. I like that. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. Yeah, pluck yourself off the throne and get out of the way. Come on, you know? See, we never know where we're going to go once I start talking. Okay. Okay, so I think that this is the first mention of tithing. I think that's what's going on here. I think that they knew they were instructed. Otherwise, you would not have Yahweh say, if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. If you do your own thing, your own way, then you're sinning right there. And you could be in a place called sin, meaning that this is a status now. It's not just a choice you made once. Now you're going to be walking in it as a habitual behavior. And its desire is for you, but you should master it. You should have mastery over, he said its desire is for you. In other words, your desire is to do your way, your thing, it's you. It's right there. He says its desire is for you, but you should master what? It, which is what? You. Get some mastery over you. Get a hold of yourself, get control over yourself, and submit yourself under him. Interesting. Now let's go to Genesis 14. So here we see Cain and Chavel. I know some of you are saying, oh, that's a stretch, Rabbi. I don't know that really was tithing. Okay. Let's Genesis 14. We'll see absolutely clear tithing going on here. In Genesis 14, and we'll begin in verse 16. Now this is after Avram goes and rescues Lot, and we have this little thing going on with the kings of Sodom and Amorah, etc. In verse 16 it says, so he brought back all the goods, and also brought back his brother Lot, this is Avram, and his goods, as well as the women and the people. And after his return from the defeat of Kedorlaomer, and from the sovereigns who were with him, the sovereign of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the sovereign's valley. And Melchizedek, sovereign of Shalem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was the priest of the Most High El. Now let's see what we have going on here. So after the battle's over, we have the king of Sodom coming out to meet, and then also we see the king of Shalom, the king of Salem. This would be the king of what became eventually Jerusalem, is what we would understand this to possibly be. This is the king. And so he's coming out, and he's also priest of the Most High El. Not priest of some pagan god, not priest of some pagan deity. He is priest of Yahweh, the Most High El. And he's called Melchizedek, which is actually a conjunction of Melech and Tzaddik, or King Righteous, or Righteous King, okay? And so he then brings out bread and wine. So we're going to take a little rabbi trail here for 2 seconds to say, this is where the Kiddush and Motzi comes from, not the Catholic Church's communion ceremony. Okay, the reason why Yeshua did this at the Last Supper, the reason why the Jews still do it today, is because of this recorded event. There was a tradition when people would come together to fellowship and to break bread, or to do something serious together, they would break bread and have wine. And so Melchizedek brings out the bread and the wine. And he sits there with Avram to have the bread and the wine. And so this is your first mention of the Kiddush and the Motzi that we do before our meals. And I always have to remind people, this is not communion. The Catholic Church invented that concept. This goes all the way back here. Genesis 14, that's a long time before there ever was a Catholic Church. It's a long time before the Last Supper. Now, what Yeshua was simply doing at the Last Supper, saying, you know this thing that you do with the bread and the wine, and you guys do this like every day? I want you to now use it as a trigger to think about me. I want you to think about me and remember me, because this is something you do every day. So when you eat that bread, remember, I'm the bread of life. When you drink of that wine, it looks like blood. It's red. It looks like blood. Hey, remember my shed blood, which is shed for you. Because he liked to use things that were everyday things to remind you of what he taught, what he taught us, and to remind you about him. So now here it says, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Avram. So this is Melchizedek talking. Blessed be Avram of the Most High El, possessor of the heavens and the earth. And blessed be the Most High El who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And then after receiving the blessing, it says, and he gave him a tenth of all. Now, Melchizedek is not giving the tithe to Avram. Some people have actually tried to say this. Because look, we started off in verse 16 where it says, and he brought back all the goods and also brought back Lot. He had all this stuff. So then Avram gives Melchizedek a tithe of all. And then the sovereign of Sodom, says to Avram, now he sees what just happened. He goes, hey, you're giving that to Melchizedek. He says, well, look, give me the people and take the goods for yourself. I see you're giving away goods. I don't want any goods. I just want the people. And Avram said to the sovereign of Sodom, I've lifted my hand to Yahweh, the Most High El, the possessor of heavens and earth, not to take a thread or a sandal strap or whatever is yours, lest you should say, I have made Avram rich. Except only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me. And that's it. He says, let them take their portion. He says, look, I'm not here to take any of that stuff. However, the tithe belongs to Yahweh. And he gave a tenth to the representative of Yahweh. Here is your precedent. Okay, we call it the law of first mention. It's not really a law, but it's something that the Jews have extrapolated out by watching and observing that the first time something is mentioned in the scriptures, we get huge amounts of understanding about what that is and what it means and how it's applied. So here it is. This is the first place we see this event happening. And what we see is that the tithe is being given to the representative of the Most High El. So hopefully that should show that this is not a Levite. Levi has not been born. Okay, Avram has not even had Isaac yet. Okay, we do not even have that. And so here we're dealing with this. There's no Isaac, there's no Jacob, there's no Levi. This is Melchizedek. And so those who work in the representation of the priesthood of the Most High El, before we had the Levites, were called the Melchizedek priesthood. Now, this piece right here that we see happening, it says that this person was king of Shalom as well as the priest of the Most High El. And we may say to ourselves, okay, so who was this? Who was this? Now, we look in the book of Hebrews and it says that Melchizedek was without generation or without genealogy, without beginning, without end. So naturally, everybody goes, it was Yeshua. Well, that's not what's going on here. By the way, all the Jews understand this to be Shem. It's in all their writings and all of their understanding. When they teach the Torah portion that involves Genesis 14, they mention that it's Shem, the son of Noah, Shem. Okay, remember Noah had the three sons and one of them was Shem. So this is Shem, but also, and by the way, if you do your genealogies, you'll see that Shem not only was old enough and still alive to be here, but he also outlives Abraham. So he was old enough to be at the wedding of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And by the way, later we're going to read that Jacob promises to give a tithe to Yahweh. Well, who do you think he's giving it to? Shem. And so we find out that through the writings that are peripheral, and we talk about this occasionally, that there are some uses to peripheral writings, that in the Jewish writings, in the book of Jasher and other places, it mentions that this is Shem. Without any other evidence to the contrary, that is our best guess that this is Shem. It's the most logical understanding that this is Shem. Okay, by the way, Shem means name, and the Jews have always referred to the Almighty as Hashem. We talk about reverencing the name, and so the word Shem comes up a lot. So this was the one that bared the name after Noah had children, that this is the one that bared the name, represented the name. His name was Shem. And we got to remember from Scripture, when children were named, their names meant something. We don't always do that today anymore. Some people do, but most people don't. And so this is the one who bore the name. This was Shem, okay? This was Shem. By the way, we also will see as this goes forward that at this point, Avram in the genealogy is from Shem. So he's a descendant of Shem. And I think that if you start counting with him, he ends up being either eighth from Shem, if you don't count Shem, otherwise he's ninth, going down the order. Okay, and the Jews also understand that Avram becomes a Melchizedekian priest of that order. Now let's get back to this whole thing in Hebrews where it says, according to the order of Melchizedek, without genealogy. Now, why would it say without genealogy? It's only saying without genealogy because it's saying that you don't need genealogy to be a Melchizedekian priest. In other words, to be a Levitical priest, what do you need? Genealogy to Aaron. You need genealogy that traces back to Aaron. To be a Kohen. To be a high priest. And so here's a high priest being talked about in the book of Hebrews that doesn't need genealogy. In other words, it can come from any tribe. So that's the only reason why it was mentioned, because it was saying is, how can Yeshua, who is high priest, for which there's no law to allow him to be priest. He's not Levite. He's not Kohen. And they said, because he's of the order of Melchizedek, and Melchizedek doesn't require a genealogical line, it requires a discipleship. Those priests are discipled and anointed and selected through discipleship. They're not by birth, by genealogy. Does that make more sense now? So when it says without genealogy, it doesn't mean he doesn't have any, because by the way, I read Matthew and Luke, and Messiah had genealogy. So you can't use that as an excuse to say, well, it's Messiah because he didn't have genealogy. Really? Start in Matthew chapter 1. There's a lot of genealogy. All for Yeshua. Right? That's, so he had genealogy. But his genealogy went back to Judah, which is what he was prophesied to be from, not to Levi. He's the Lion of Judah. But what we find out is that you can go back to any tribe and be qualified, if trained, anointed, appointed, and discipled, to be a Melchizedekian priest, which is the priesthood that we're all looking forward to being a part of. Because the Levitical priesthood was the priesthood that did temple service, the tent of meeting, all of that judging and offerings and sacrifice stuff. The Melchizedekian priesthood was the discipling Torah teaching priesthood. And so we can have the understanding, and we do get that also from the book of Yashar, that Avram knew who Yahweh was when Yahweh said, Avram, and said, you need to go and go where I send you to go. Avram didn't sit there going, who are you? Because Shem had already trained him. Avram trained in the yeshiva run by Noah and Shem. And he was discipled. And so the discipling, you then see when we finally get to Moshe, that Moshe is the Melchizedekian priest and Aaron is the Levitical priest, the Kohen. And you have both priesthoods going at the same time. Because who was teaching Torah when Moses was there? Moses and then the 70 elders who were prophesying or speaking just like Moses, speaking the word with authority. And so you see the Melchizedekian priesthood is those that are representing the Almighty in the instruction and discipleship in the walk of Torah. And so we see that Avram gives a tithe to that person. Ah, but he's not Levitical. No Levitical priest for a long time after this. A long time. So what are we dealing with? We're dealing with the idea that the priesthood, again, is being supported without an inheritance by the tithes of those that they're working with. Because that's what's given then to the Most High. Okay, so we see that Avraham gives the tenth to Melchizedek. Let's now go to Genesis 28, and we'll see the same thing where Yaakov makes a promise. We just mentioned that, but we'll read it now. In Genesis 28 and verse 20, and Yaakov made a vow saying, seeing Elohim is with me and has kept me in this way that I am going and has given me bread to eat and a garment to put on, when I have returned to my father's house in peace, and Yahweh has been my Elohim, then this stone which I have set as a standing column shall be Elohim's house, and all that Yahweh that you give me, I shall certainly give a tenth to you. So who was he going to give it to? Again, the research showed that Shem was still around, and that he was likely the one that he would give it to, because Yahweh wasn't just showing up to collect the tithes and the offerings. He's never done that. He's always done it through people. So Yaakov's promising to give the tithe, okay? And so this is important as we go through this. So let's see if I have time for one more piece of this. I probably do. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 14. Now, by the way, we didn't read the verses to cover this yet. We'll read more verses to do it. That tithe that we just read, we read very clearly. Let's kind of reiterate before I read Deuteronomy 14. That tithe, were you allowed to have any piece of that for yourself? Were you allowed to eat of it, spend it, do anything with it yourself? If you tried to do anything with it, what were you supposed to do? Pay back a fifth. You were not to tamper with. That was to go to who? Yahweh. How? Through the Levites. So there was no messing with this tithe for you. You couldn't eat it. You couldn't spend it. You couldn't do anything with it. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall tithe without fail all the yield of your grain that the field brings forth year by year. And you shall eat before Yahweh your Elohim in the place where he chooses to make his name dwell. The tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil and the firstlings of your herds and your sheep, so that you learn to fear Yahweh your Elohim always. Oops. You're going to tithe without fail, year by year, and you're going to eat that tithe before Yahweh in a place he chooses? How is that working out? So some people have said, well, there's a problem between the people in the book of Numbers and the people in the book of Deuteronomy. Same people? Not a confusion? He says, but when the way is too long for you so that you're not able to bring the tithe, this is verse 24, or when the place where Yahweh your Elohim chooses to put his name is too far from you, when Yahweh your Elohim is blessing you, then you shall give it in silver and shall take the silver in your hand and go to the place which Yahweh your Elohim chooses. So this is talking about what? Feast keeping. Why would you be traveling to a place that might be too far to bring your tithe? Because that's how they kept the feast. Three times a year, you took your tithe and you brought it to Jerusalem, brought it to the priesthood, and you came to celebrate the feasts. But he's telling you as though there's a tithe that you gather year by year. Okay? In other words, no carryover to the next year. It's a year-by-year tithe. People have asked about this. That's the verse that kind of helps you understand that. You're going to do it year by year. So there's no carry forward if you had excess, but this is a tithe that you, now let's listen to it, so in case we're not clear, you get to enjoy. Listen to verse 26. And you shall use the silver. Remember, you took your tithe, the place was too far, and you turned it into silver. For whatever your being desires, for cattle or sheep or wine or strong drink, for whatever your being desires. And you shall eat there before Yahweh your Elohim, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. So you are going to take this money and get whatever you want and enjoy it and have the abundance for yourself? Does that match up at all with the tithe that we read about that was for the inheritance of the Levites? No. Is there any confusion or contradiction or conflict in the word of Yahweh? No. So I think the most logical thing is to guess is that this is a different tithe. Is that reasonable? Because the one you couldn't do anything with, and this one you're supposed to enjoy. And this one also goes forth year by year. Now he says to bring it to the place. He didn't say to Jerusalem. He didn't say to the Levite. He said to the place where Yahweh chooses to place his name. So people will say, well, we're not there today. We don't go to Jerusalem and there's no temple. But you know what? Yahweh has chosen for you to be in dispersion. Hasn't he? He's chosen to place his name in the dispersion while you're there so that he can call you out and work with you until he brings you back to the land. So it's my speculation here, then it is appropriate to still do tithing in the dispersion, in the places where he has chosen to place his name. In other words, when you find a place where you see him there, is that here in this congregation? I don't know. You have to know. If it's not where you're going on a regular basis, then maybe you need to find someplace else to go. Just because somebody claims to be representing him doesn't mean they do. You got to look for the pillar of cloud or pillar of fire over that congregation, so to speak, in a metaphor. You go and you see if his presence is there. Is the work being done? Is the anointing and the appointing there? That would be a place where he chooses to put his name. That's the way I'm understanding it. Okay? By the way, in verse 26, it says, wine or strong drink for all the... I don't want to pick too much on the Adventists, but I used to argue with them all the time about this idea that Yeshua turned the water into grape juice. The verse here is Yahweh speaking through Moses, and in Hebrew it is Yayin and Shakar, and the Yayin doesn't mean, you know, fresh grapes that have just been crushed. It means wine, and the Shakar is highly intoxicating. It's hard liquor, basically. Okay, we're talking about like grain alcohol. He's telling them right up front here, look at the Hebrew word. It means highly intoxicating beverage. So let's not argue all the teetotalers and all the guys who don't want to be, you know, anything with the alcohol. Yeshua did turn the water into an alcoholic beverage and good stuff at that. Okay, because that was the whole idea, was to bring it to the wine steward and have him be like, wow. Because you know what would happen? These weddings would go 7 days, and they would put the good stuff out the first day, and then when they were all drunk after a couple of days, put the cheap stuff out, they'll never know the difference. And so now the wedding's almost over, and now this stuff is being brought to the wine store. It's like, whoa, where did the good stuff come from? That doesn't usually come out at the end. So Yeshua turned it into some good stuff. Now, as we're going through this, understand this tithe clearly is something that you were supposed to be enjoying. You were spending on whatever you wanted, okay? Now, why are we doing all of this? Let's continue down. It says, and do not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, and he has no part of the inheritance with you. In other words, don't do this and forget that there's another tithe for them. Not share this one with them. Don't forget that they get theirs. Does that make more sense than maybe you read it before? Because people thought, well, I'm supposed to take this tithe and enjoy it. I'm supposed to also share it with the Levites, so why am I doing the other one? No, he says, don't forsake them. They have one that's for them. This is for you. He says, and at the end of every third year, you bring out all the tithe of your increase of that year and store it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion, and the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your gates shall come and eat and be satisfied. Now, understand why this is all happening before I explain this third one, this third year thing. He says, this is so that Yahweh your Elohim does bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. Tithing is so that he will bless you. We tithe to show that we appreciate the blessings we already have and showing that we trust that it will continue to bring blessings. Now, there is this third year thing. It's called to bring out all the tithe, and we're going to get into that in a minute here, this tithing thing. But I want to read you something out of the Jewish Encyclopedia. I just printed this out here. According to the rabbis, the book of Numbers and Deuteronomy are complementary to each other. In other words, they don't conflict. Consequently, there can be no contradiction between them. Thus, there were three kinds of tithes. One, this is, by the way, the 1906 Jewish Encyclopedia. So this is, you know, not part of the Messianic movement of modern day times. This is not part. This is a Jewish written, Jewish thing, compilation. It says, the first tithe that was given to the Levites is stated in Numbers and termed the first tithe, Mahaser Rishon. Okay, Mahaser was the tithes. Okay, Truma being offerings. Okay, Maaser Rishon, Rishon meaning the primary or the first. Okay, the second, the tithe which was given to be taken to Jerusalem and there consumed by the landowner and his family, which was termed the second tithe or Maaser Sheni. Okay, it being taken from what remained after the first tithe had been appropriated. Now they have this idea of trying to understand it, the first tithe can't be touched. So there's a little confusion in there, but that was the one to be brought to Jerusalem. Why? So that you could celebrate the feast and have abundance. How many of you, I want to have you admit for yourselves, either you or know somebody that said that they would have liked to have come to Sukkot or Passover, but they said they couldn't afford it. Anybody know any people like that? Couldn't afford it. Well, if you tithe, you have the money. Abba wants to take away all your excuses keeping the feasts. So I don't care if you make as little as $20,000 a year. You know what? If you make $10 an hour, that is $20,800 a year. That is $2,000 tithe to spend twice a year, three times a year, really, on feasts. Don't tell me that you can't afford to go to a feast. Almost all of you make somewhere close to that at least. So I don't understand the problem. Well, the problem is you're not trusting him, you're not tithing. But you don't understand. I can't even pay my bills now because you're not tithing. And by the way, if you started tithing, you might fill in all of the leaks in your budget. Because then you'll realize that there are leaks that you need to plug. Okay, so you have the first and the second tithe. And then it says number three, that which is given to the poor. Therefore, the two tithes were taken up. Listen now, the two tithes were taken up every year except in the seventh, because that was the year of release. He says, and numbers one and two are in the were the first tithes and the second tithes were done in the first, second, fourth, and fifth years. The other ones were done in the third and sixth years, all three of them. Okay, so all three tithes in the third and sixth year. That's why the third year is going to be referred to in one of the verse reads as the year of tithing. Oh, yeah, because you're doing a lot of tithing that year in the third and the sixth. So this is from the Jewish Encyclopedia, how some of these things got compiled. So they even recognize that there are three. By the way, in the book of Tobit, which is another external book, but it's in the Catholic books, but in the book of Tobit, which by the way dates back to about 225 to 175 BC, all right? It doesn't quite fit the time frame that they want to claim it to be a little older than that, but a lot of the scholars all seem to agree it's about 225 to 175. In the book of Tobit, Tobit is saying, look, while my family members and others, you know, were in captivity in Nineveh, I kept walking out the walk. Now listen to this. It says, I, Tobit, have walked all the days of my life in the paths of fidelity and righteousness. I perform my charitable deeds for my kindred and my people who have been taken captive with me to Nineveh in the land of the Assyrians. When I lived as a young man in my own country in the land of Israel, the entire tribe of my ancestor Naphtali broke away from the house of David, my ancestor, and from Jerusalem, the city that had been singled out of all the tribes that all Israel might offer sacrifice there. It was the place where the temple, God's dwelling, had been built and consecrated for all generations to come. All my kindred, as well as the house of Naphtali, my ancestor, used to offer sacrifice on every hilltop in Galilee to the calf that Jeroboam, king of Israel, had made in Dan. But I alone used to go off into Jerusalem. So he said, I didn't go and do the Jeroboam thing. He says, for the festivals, as was prescribed for all Israel, by long-standing decree, bringing with me the first fruits of crops, the firstlings of the flock, the tithes of the livestock, and the first shearings of the sheep, I used to hasten to Jerusalem and present them to the priests, Aaron's sons, at the altar. To the Levites ministering in Jerusalem, I used to give the tithe of the grain, the wine, the olive oil, pomegranates, figs, and other fruits. 6 years in a row, I used to give a second tithe in money, which each year I would go to pay in Jerusalem. So he had a first tithe and the second tithe, which was for the feasts. And whatever was excess that he didn't need, he would give. That's where there's no carryover. The third year tithe I gave to the orphans, widows, and converts who had joined the Israelites. Every third year I would bring them this offering, and we ate it in keeping with the decree laid down in the Mosaic law concerning it. So here's a writing that is ancient enough as a historical document to let us know that there's a guy who was keeping all three tithes. Oh, it's an extra witness to that doing of the tithing. Does it belong in your Bible? I didn't say that. But it is a historical document that does give evidence that three tithes were being maintained. The one that went to the Levites, the second one that was brought to Jerusalem, and whatever was not used to enjoy the feast was given in Jerusalem to the Levites, and then the third one, which was used for the poor, which he did every third and sixth year in the seven-year cycle. Just more evidence. So I'm just giving you some backup to the fact that this idea of three tithes is not something that your crazy rabbi just made up. There is some documentation and evidence to these things. Now, it was applied in different ways going through history as people, again, tried to find excuses to do less. But we see in the oldest of the documents, the one from Tobit, there were the two that were brought to Jerusalem. One was given to Aaron's sons, and the other was unto the Levites, and the other one was given to the Levites after using whatever he used to enjoy the feasts. That's why I tell everyone, the feast cycle, when it ends, you are no longer collecting for that year your tithe. You now give whatever's left to the priesthood of the time. At the end of Sukkot, after Shemini Atzeret, you start from zero. So you have yet a third calendar counting. You have the calendar of feasts, which starts in Aviv. You have the calendar of Shemitah, which starts in Tishrei. And then you have the calendar of tithing, which starts after the last feast. You start collecting for the next one. Because you really would only be collecting feast to feast, and you wouldn't keep over your excess each feast. You would need what you needed to go to Jerusalem, use it, and leave the rest there behind. If you want to do that on an annual basis, because you may have some bumps and hiccups in your income, fine, use it for your feast for that year. At the end of the feast cycle, that's it. Start again. And so let's understand, as we start to figure this all out, that there are three. And there's evidence of the three. There's the one that is absolutely for the one doing the work of service before Yahweh, whoever that is. We know that there's precedent to show that that doesn't have to be Levitical. That could be Melchizedekian. The one, you need someone without inheritance. I can promise you, I get phone calls every hour of the day. Not every day, all day, but I get calls at 2 in the morning. I get calls at 10 at night. I get calls at 3 in the afternoon. I get calls at 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning. Well, Robert takes those. But we get calls. How early do the calls start? 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. They start and they don't stop sometimes at 2 o'clock in the morning, almost a full day later. And we need the people to be available. When you need one of us to be there, when you have need, you need us to be there. And I can promise you, I know people that cannot take calls at their job. And if I had a secular job, I wouldn't be able to take your calls. You might be not happy with that possibility. Now, some of you don't get it because you haven't needed. Or you've needed and never took advantage of what was available to you. One day you will need. And you'll be very happy if it's available to you. You'll be very frustrated if it's not. And shame on you if you complain when it's not available, if you're not supporting it. And shame on you if you take advantage of it being available and you're not supporting it. Because all of the tithing is to show your appreciation for the blessing. You show up to the Levites and you say, Abba, I appreciate the blessing of having a priesthood. I appreciate that there's those that serve, and I want to provide that blessing, that ability to give them that inheritance. When it comes to the feast, you're going and saying, Abba, I appreciate the blessing of the abundance so that I can come here and celebrate before you. And then when it comes to the poor, we're appreciating that we can share the abundance with them. When it comes to the poor, we want to show that we want to share the abundance with them. Okay, there's another chapter that I'll cover that covers that more next time about the third tithe. But it's the idea of sharing blessings with those in need. Is this making sense? Okay? And so we're going to get into more of the mechanics of this. We're going to talk more about all the other things tithing does. Tithing was a part of the restoration process. Tithing was a part of all kinds of other cool things. And we're going to get into that in part two and maybe three as we go further. Let's pray. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King, Father, we come before you and we want to pause to recognize that in all that we're doing here and in the word and the message and that you provide to us, that you are that one. We're sitting here eating of your word and we've eaten and we are satisfied. And Father, we want to thank you. We want to thank you that we don't have a famine of the word. We want to thank you that we have access and that you've given us those who can share that word. Father, we thank you for an understanding, and hopefully we'll gain a much deeper understanding and appreciation for what tithing is all about and who it was for, and to realize really, first and foremost, it's for us. We need the tithing, not the Levite, not the priest, not you, but that you gave us this tithing process because it's something we need. And so, Father, we thank you. We ask that you continue to open our eyes, our hearts, our beings to receive what you have for us to receive. As we come before you now in this understanding, patiently awaiting the rest of the teaching, and we come before you in authority of our Messiah, our High Priest, according to the order of Melchizedek, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen. Amen.